We've talked about this subject a lot on Issues, Etc. The sexual revolution. And in discussing the sexual revolution on the program, I will have to admit we have overlooked a major factor. As often as we've talked about it, every once in a while we'll bump into it. We've done a show or two on this, but one cannot discuss the sexual revolution and its consequences without discussing contraception. Now, granted, this first hour's conversation might rub you the wrong way as we talk about the contraceptive revolution and its social impact in Western culture, but we at least have to consider it. It's not a small thing. Yes, the pill is a small thing, but it's not a small thing in the course of the sexual revolution and its consequences. We'll be discussing that here in the first hour of Issues, Etc. Dr. Brad Wilcox will join us in just a moment. I'm Todd Wilkin. I invite you to join our conversation as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. That's the first half hour's conversation. Open lines follows that. I'd like your answer to this question. Consider the consequences of contraception. Has it been a good or an ill for society? That means you should listen carefully to the next 25 minutes. Then we'll talk about it open lines for the remainder of the first hour. In the second hour, Dr. Carl Fikencher joins us today. The church celebrates the presentation of our Lord, Mary Joseph, and the baby Jesus there at the temple. Something very unusual happens. We'll talk about it with Dr. Fikencher in the second hour of the program. From 4:30 until 5, Jennifer Roback Morse will be our guest. She's going to give us a review of Dr. Phil's book, Family First. Family First. My wife has this sitting on the bedside table. She likes Dr. Phil. She likes the book. We'll see what Jennifer Roback Morse has to say about it. Also, she's written an article on the importance of fathers, and it'll go nicely with that review of Dr. Phil's book. Then, in the last hour of the program, I should say, David Van Bima has written the cover story for Time Magazine. He's a senior writer for Time Magazine. We'll talk with him. The story's about the 25 most influential evangelicals, among them Billy Graham and his son Franklin, Rick Warren, James Dobson, T.D. Jakes, the LaHayes. I could go on. The article does. We'll talk about that for about 20 minutes with David Van Bima, author of the story. And then again, open lines to round off today's program. After we've looked at the list, I'll want to know from you, who's left out? Who do you think is the most influential evangelical in the United States today? That's the lineup for today's Issues, Etc. Brad Wilcox is our guest here for the first 25 minutes. He's assistant professor of sociology at the University of Virginia, author of the book Soft Patriarchs, New Men, How Christianity Shapes Fathers and Husbands. And he's also written an article for the latest Touchstone magazine titled The Facts of Life and Marriage. Dr. Wilcox, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thanks for having me today, Todd.
You begin by talking about a 1968 document, Humanae Vitae, from a previous pope. And if you talk to the average Roman Catholic today, this is not an exclusively Catholic conversation, of course, but if you talk to the average Roman Catholic, they're ambivalent about the whole issue of contraception. Has the church's teaching on this, the Roman church's teaching on this, been equivocal? Has it always been consistent?
The Catholic Church's teaching on this issue has been consistent over the last, since really our Lord's death and resurrection. Now, of course, it's been articulated at times more clearly than at other times. And the point that I make in the article for Touchstone is that the teaching was coming into question in the 1960s for a variety of reasons, which you can imagine. And finally, the Pope actually went against the recommendation of a committee that was made up of laity and clergy and had suggested a change on this topic. And he went against that recommendation and reaffirmed the Catholic Church's constant teaching on contraception.
How would you summarize that teaching?
Well, the basic idea is that, the teaching is that, any forms of artificial birth control are immoral. And the rationale here is that basically the body is a temple of the Holy Spirit, that pregnancy is a blessing. Children are a heritage unto the Lord, and that we should welcome children. We should welcome the gift of fertility, and that we should not take it upon ourselves to really enter into this most, if you will, sacred domain with the pill, with, you know, condoms, IUDs, you know, you name it. And there's obviously a tradition here, too, that actually is also found in the Reformed tradition. As you probably know, both Luther and Calvin believed that children were a blessing and were opposed to contraception, and also were opposed to more primitive means of birth control, like early withdrawal, which, of course, was more common in their day. So the point simply is that there are both kind of traditional and theological grounds for opposing contraception, and they've been affirmed across a range of Christian traditions over time.
One more question on the articulation of this opposition to contraception in the Roman Church. You say that the Pope's statement that clarified the Church's position came at pretty much, well, at least was issued at pretty much the worst possible time for a healthy reception of this position. What do you mean?
Well, in the 1960s and of course in the 1970s, we saw a dramatic sexual revolution across the West. And actually, I would argue that the pill played a key role here, because the pill only came online, of course, in the early 1960s. And it allowed men and women to have sex without worrying about getting pregnant. So it really changed the fundamental kind of dynamic, if you will, that had previously governed sexual relations. That is, the idea, obviously, before the pill was that there was a real strong likelihood that you would get pregnant if you had sex, especially if you didn't use something like a condom. So, you know, the pill really made it much easier to have sex outside of marriage. So that was one issue. And the other issue was that women were entering the workforce and getting more education at this period in the 60s and 70s. And marriages were becoming more and more adult-centered and less child-centered. And the thinking was at the time that, you know, we need to really give people all the tools that they can have to limit the number of children that they have, so they can focus more on developing a good relationship and on keeping a good relationship. And I guess the third thing I should know, and this was actually also quite important, was that there was a real concern about population growth in the 60s, late 60s and in the 70s. And so birth control was seen, obviously, as an important mechanism for limiting population. Of course, now in the West, we're seeing dramatically declining birth rates, and places like Europe, of course, are facing a huge population implosion. So it's actually the exact opposite problem that they were worrying about just 30 years ago.
How do you respond to the assertion that the Church on this issue is simply out of touch with what's happening on the ground, insensitive, inflexible to the necessities of marriage and family life in the modern world?
Well, it's obviously it's an important concern, and what I would say, the first thing that I would say is that, you know, living in accord with the gospel means that we have to, you know, to pick up our cross. And this is obviously clear in Mark 8, 34 through 35, this notion that Christians will find the cross in every part of their life, you know, in how they, or at least they should, in how they eat, you know, how they spend their money. And the argument here is that sex is not somehow one arena where the cross doesn't enter into it. And so the point, in part, is that Christians should recognize that, you know, that they're one of the kind of, well, kind of the, one of the correlates of being sexually active is, in a sense, is being open to children. And that there will, you know, are obviously sacrifices entailed in having, you know, having a large family. But there are some other points here to make too. The one point is that we live in a day and age when people are much more interested in kind of living in a natural or organic way, if you will. I mean, and we're much more careful about what we put in our bodies, and you know, with things like organic milk and the like. The irony here is people don't seem to be too reflective about the fact that you know, birth control is, you know, is basically some serious hormones that we're putting into, you know, women's bodies to control their fertility. and there are certainly lots of side effects associated with the pill. And it changes the the sexual dynamic, too, because it tends to reduce women's interest in sexual activity. So I would say that not using the pill actually is an approach that's more appreciative of a woman's body and her fertility. And the third point that I would make is the church doesn't teach that you have to have as many kids as you possibly can. It teaches that you should be open to God's gift of fertility. But in a prayerful spirit, if you recognize that there are economic, serious economic, medical, or psychological downsides to having another child, at that point, the church would encourage a couple to use natural family planning, which is where a couple monitors the wife's temperature in the morning, and doing that and charting it out, they can figure out which days she is fertile and abstain from sexual intercourse on those days. And it's kind of, the analogy here is it's kind of like fasting. You know, it's this is one way in which, you know, Christians can draw closer to the Lord in these periods of abstinence. And also, you know, just a practical side effect is that Christian couples who do abstain for a period of time each month, I think, also appreciate sexual intimacy even more after that period of time. So there is a kind of a recognition on the church's part that, you know, that not everyone's going to have, you know, five or six or seven or more kids.
You look at the social consequences of contraception, and you say that the arguments for accommodating the culture on this issue, for saying, come on, we have lost the war against contraception, let's just mitigate our position on it as a church. You say that those arguments are really based on bad social science. What do you mean?
Well, the interesting thing here is that, I mean, social scientists, who are obviously by no means conservative in the main, have done a lot of research on things like contraception, cohabitation, and divorce. And, you know, the consensus is that on average for a society, these types of things, which run counter to at least the classic Christian moral tradition, you know, really have serious negative consequences. Obviously, we can focus here just on contraception. But prior to the 1960s and the introduction of the pill, you know, we had relatively low rates of out-of-wedlock childbearing and relatively low rates of premarital sexual activity. But when the pill was introduced, as I said, it totally changed the calculus that went into young people's, primarily young people's minds about whether or not they should be sexually active. And it allowed, if you think about, the guy who's sort of done the most work on this is a guy named George Akerlof, who's in a Nobel Prize winning economist at Berkeley, and he's by no means a conservative, he's a liberal. But his argument basically is that if you look at this time, there were basically three types of women. There were the traditionally minded women who wanted to maintain their purity, their chastity, and wouldn't have sex outside of marriage. There were the kind of the moderate but family minded women who were kind of in the middle, and because they wanted to be married and have kids, they would, you know, basically try to remain abstinent prior to marriage. And then there were the more liberal or hedonistic women who were happy to have sex before marriage, but of course also were worried about having a child before marriage, since that wasn't a good thing. And so it would still be fairly careful. And his argument is that once the pill comes on the scene, is that the hedonistic women felt free to have as much, you know, sex as they wanted to, and the more moderate women felt pressured to have more sex because their boyfriends could say, look, you know, things are changing, you know, you know, I've heard that Jane is sexually active now, and, you know, if you don't, you know, agree to have sex with me, then I might, you know, consider dating someone else. And so there was this kind of dynamic where women felt pressured, and some men took advantage of the situation to increase their sexual activity. And what we saw actually in the U.S. is that there was a dramatic increase in sexual activity among unmarried adults in the late 60s and early 70s, and it tracks, you know, just in the wake of the introduction of the pill. So there's strong kind of prima facie evidence that the pill was directly connected to this increase in premarital sex. And then shortly thereafter, there was a dramatic increase in illegitimacy. And of course, this surprised all the advocates of contraception because they thought that the introduction of the pill and then abortion in the early 70s would reduce the rate of illegitimacy. But it actually, both of them increased illegitimacy because number one, they dramatically increased premarital sex, which we've just talked about, but they also made it much more difficult for women who got pregnant to convince their boyfriends to marry them. And the thinking here is that prior to the pill and abortion, women who got pregnant could basically say, look, I have no options here. You're the one who got me pregnant, and you needed the right thing. And communities, you know, stood behind this ethic and basically, you know, encouraged men to marry women they got pregnant. But though in the wake of the introduction of the pill and then abortion, guys could say, look, you know, you could have been on the pill, and, you know, you could get an abortion. So I don't have to, you know, take responsibility for this pregnancy. It's, you know, it's your choice, and you know, I'm not going to do the right thing and marry you because, you know, you chose to have this baby. So the consequence of the pill in part was both more sexual activity outside of marriage and then secondly a dramatic increase in illegitimacy. And both of those things have had markedly negative consequences for our society. Increases in adultery, increases in STDs, and increases in kids living in single-parent homes. And, of course, we know that kids are much more likely to suffer a range of ill effects if they grow up in a single-parent home. So that's kind of my thumbnail sketch of the connection between contraception on the one hand and the sexual revolution and its poisonous fruits on the other hand.
We're talking about the social impact of the contraceptive revolution with Dr. Brad Wilcox. He's written an article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled The Facts of Life and Marriage. In just a little over 10 minutes, I want to hear from you on this. Have contraceptives been good or bad for society? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. What's the connection to divorce, if any, between that the sociologist can indicate between the pill, between contraceptives and divorce?
Well, there's a guy who's at the University of Chicago named Robert Michael, and his work on contraception and divorce indicates that about half of the increase in divorce in the late 60s and 1970s, and that's just, of course, when the divorce rate really jumps. It levels off in the early 1980s and then starts to fall gradually since then. So he argues that contraception accounts for about half of that dramatic increase in divorce in that period of time. And his basic line of argument here is that what contraception did was it fundamentally changed people's expectations of an understanding of marriage. Prior to the pill, people basically saw marriage as you get married and then, you know, pretty soon after that, you expect to have kids, you know, just naturally. And from there on out, one of the key purposes of marriage is to provide a good place to raise children. So it wasn't to minimize the fact that marriage also does other things, but the basic idea here is that one of its core purposes was marriage. And people understood that when they got married. But in the wake of the pill, people began to focus more and more on the quality of their relationship, on their careers, and on consumer items like houses, cars, vacations, things like that, as they had fewer and fewer children and tended to put off childbearing later and later. And so marriage became a much less child-centered institution, and people were therefore much more inclined to consider divorce. It also changed the dynamics between men and women because women were less dependent upon men in the wake of the contraceptive revolution because they could focus more and more of their energy and attention on working outside the home. And so, you know, anytime you decrease dependency in marriage, you're going to be obviously increasing divorce since people are going to be less and less likely to stick together. So those are some of the reasons why there was this link between the introduction of the pill in the mid-60s and early 60s, and then the divorce revolution, which just, you know, comes, you know, basically 5 years later.
With only about 30 seconds here, because I'd like some time at the end to talk about your forthcoming book, why then, why is it that you say these consequences, these social consequences of contraception, fall disproportionately on the poor?
Well, the argument here is that the poor don't have the same kind of social and economic stakes in marriage. They don't oftentimes obviously own a house with a spouse, for instance. And so they depend more on the moral norms to keep them invested in marriage. And the pill, insofar as it fueled the sexual revolution, which undercut, you know, norms against premarital sex and against illegitimacy, had a disproportionate effect on the poor because they didn't have, as I said, these sort of social and economic stakes in marriage that would otherwise keep them invested in marriage. I mean, the poor always in any society will depend more on religion and morality to keep their families intact. And when those two things are under attack, as they were in the 60s and 70s, they'll pay the bigger price in their family lives.
Your new book, Soft Patriarchs, New Men, How Christianity Shapes Fathers and Husbands. Tell us a little bit about it with only about a minute here before we go.
The basic idea is that religion domesticates men in ways that make their wives and kids, or their wife and kids, happy. And the reason I think it's interesting, particularly now, is that it contradicts a lot of the claims that feminists and journalists have made about evangelical Protestants. For instance, Stephen Cookie Roberts, who are prominent journalists, argued in the wake of the Southern Baptist statement about male headship that evangelicals would be more abusive, men would be more abusive towards their wives. And this book finds, among other things, that active church-going evangelical men have the lowest rates of domestic violence of any group of husbands in the country. So the, you know, the idea here is that religion, particularly more orthodox or conservative religions, tend to orient men towards the needs and interests of their families.
Brad Wilcox is assistant professor of sociology at the University of Virginia, author of the book he just mentioned, Soft Patriarchs, New Men, How Christianity Shapes Fathers and Husbands. And he's also written this article in the latest edition of Touchstone Magazine titled The Facts of Life and Marriage. Dr. Wilcox, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you so much, Doc.
All right, after this break, I'd like your answer to this question. What do you think about contraceptive in terms of its social impact? Has it been good or ill for society? According to the research that is assembled by Dr. Wilcox, we are looking at something that has connections to divorce, adultery, illegitimacy, the spread of STDs. It's hard to argue that any of those things are really good for society. And if the line can be drawn back, at least in part, to contraceptives and the social acceptance of contraceptives, the rise of the pill and its common place in our society, well, how would you argue that contraceptives have been anything but bad for society? I want to hear your answers to those questions after the break. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, our in-studio email address for that hour of open lines, as well, issuesetc@kfuo.org. We'll be right back with your calls.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The entire Old Testament book of Joshua is built upon a promise that God made in the book of Genesis to Abraham to give his descendants the promised land. But is there more to this promise and to the book of Joshua than simply the land of Israel? How should we rightly understand the book of Joshua in light of Jesus Christ? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for February is the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. The book is $42.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for the Issues Etc. book of the month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. It's the Concordia Commentary on Joshua, the Issues Etc. book of the month for February.
Now this Global Minute asks you to picture this common situation. Missionaries with New Tribes missions are surveying an area. There's evidence a missionary or evangelistic crusade was here at one time. Yet instead of one group of Christian converts and another group still steeped in old pagan traditions, they find the tribal villagers involved in a new religion, combining Bible verses with pagan practices. It's called syncretism. Syncretism can be found here in the U.S. as well. In this post-Christian era, many are totally illiterate of the scriptures. For example, John Cross of Good Seed was teaching an evangelistic Bible study and was interrupted by a man saying, "Stop, stop, stop, you're talking about God as if he were a being, like a person." The man was confused. He thought of God as some sort of force. Pray that when we as Christians present the gospel message, we make sure our listeners understand. Learn more at missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. A treasured little card I have, 2.5 inches by 5.5 inches, says, "United States House of Representatives, admit bearer to the visitors gallery. Addressed to the Congress, President George W. Bush, February 27, 2001. I was there, and it was an awesome experience, not just for a Midwestern boy, but for the political workers with whom I socialized after the speech. With all its ritual, tonight's State of the Union address shows democracy at work." This from Monday's Washington Post. "Yesterday, Americans finally got a good look at who they are fighting for. Millions of average people who have suffered for years under dictatorship and who now desperately want to live in a free and peaceful country. Their votes were an act of courage and faith, and an answer to the question of whether the mission in Iraq remains a just cause." Although not yet democracy in full bloom, as we'll see it tonight, the bud is there, and we pray and work for its unfolding. The Christmas hymn says, "He rules the world with truth and grace, and makes the nations prove the glories of his righteousness and wonders of his love." Most of the time, we simply trust that is true, even when evidence is lacking. These days, we are privileged to thank God for glimpses of its truth.
Next time on the Bible study, Acts chapter 26, the Apostle Paul is on trial, and he gets an opportunity to make his case, his defense, before King Agrippa. How will he defend himself and prove that he is innocent? We'll talk about it with Pastor Richard Moore of Emmanuel Chapel in North St. Louis County next time on The Bible Study, 10:05 in the morning.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
All right, think about it for a moment. Divorce, STDs, illegitimacy, an earlier date for sexual activity, people having sex without respect to any responsibilities that may be entailed there. All of these are social ills, right? Can we all agree on that? That these are social ills by and large. Now, there are times when, say for the sake of argument here, that divorce is altogether necessary. It may be a necessary evil. It may be something that's permitted by Scripture. But its impact on society is not good, especially when we think about society from the ground up, from the children up. Not good. In fact, we're going to be talking with Jennifer Roback Morse a little bit later in the program, and she says if people worked half as hard on their marriages as they do on their divorces, that is, trying to keep things together after their divorce, keeping the kids back and forth, people wouldn't get divorced. We're going to be talking about that, but it's a social ill. And I'm not saying to you divorcees out there that you have caused the downfall of society. What I'm saying is its impact has been negative on society. If these things can be drawn back, as we did with our previous conversation here with Dr. Brad Wilcox, if these things can be drawn back in a line to not only the sexual revolution in general, but to one part of the sexual revolution that is often left out, and that is contraceptives, then what do you think? The overall impact of contraceptives on society, good or ill? That's my question for you for the next 25 minutes of Issues, etc. I know this is controversial. I know that this is something that we generally don't talk about here on Issues, etc. I will guarantee you we'll be talking about it more as we continue to get more data on the whole issue. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, the Roman Church's position on contraceptives is unambiguous. They oppose it. And I know that not all Catholics do, but the Roman Church does very clearly and in many places oppose contraceptives. A lot of other churches have no position to speak of, or if they take a position, they take a position generally leaning in favor of contraceptives. But by and large, they'll say, well, the responsible use of contraceptives. We don't want contraceptives to be misused for encouraging sin, but they themselves are not really a problem. Should the church reevaluate, should the Protestant church in general reevaluate its position on birth control? In fact, in that article that was written in Touchstone by our guest in the previous hour, Brad Wilcox, he quotes a regular guest here on this program, Albert Mohler, who says, look, you just can't, if you look at the social science here, you cannot deny that contraceptives have played a major role in the society's ills that we are all worried about today. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. A little bit later in the program, we're going to be talking about the top 25 influential evangelicals, and Time Magazine has a story on this. Well, I was looking at Time Magazine. I'm flipping through the pages, and I get past the story about the influential evangelicals, and something catches my eye. It looks for all the world like a very complicated diagram of a molecule. And then it says, Chains of Affection, a Snapshot of Teen Sex. Now, those headlines always get my attention. Why? I am the father of a teenage girl. And stories like this in today's Time Magazine, you're going to have to look back near the back of the magazine for the diagram and for the story, strike fear in the heart of any red-blooded father or mother. Whether your kids are teenagers or not, the diagram is not a molecule. It is a picture, a representation of the sexual chain, the sexual relationship in one Midwest high school. Look at this thing, Craig. The blue dots are the boys, and the pink dots are the girls, and that's how they're all sexually connected through sexual relationships. What does it look like? It looks like everybody's connected to everybody else. Now, the upshot of the story is that this is, and it says there in the poll quote, it's a worst-case scenario for the spread of sexually transmitted diseases. Some of these pink dots, these girls, are surrounded by a ring of blue dots. Some of these blue dots are surrounded by a ring of pink dots, and they're all connected to everybody else. This is not just 6 degrees of separation. This is, it looks like a roadmap of London, for all I know. I mean, have you ever seen the roadmap of London? This isn't just 6 degrees of separation. This is the person that you slept with last weekend was sleeping with someone else that last week, and that person was sleeping with and how many partners did they have? You know, the AIDS community has known this for a long time. That when you sleep with someone, you're sleeping with everybody they ever slept with before. Well, these are our teenagers in an average Midwest town. And it's a real high school. They're calling it anonymously Jefferson City High School, but it's not in Jefferson City, so don't get worried there. Would we see a diagram like this if it were not for the contraceptive revolution? If these kids didn't have ready and easy access to the pill and to condoms? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. If you want to see the diagram, go to time.com and look for a snapshot of teen sex. Put it in the search engine. It's by Claudia Wallace. Unbelievable. And it's not a bunch of boys and a few girls. 61% boys, 55% girls in this high school were involved in this chain of, they call it a chain of affection. And then below they have some little diagrams of the most common patterns of intersexual relationships. And we're not talking about group sex. We're talking about one person sleeping with another person just over multiple partnerships. And it boggles my mind as a parent. And I'm wondering whether or not, how much contraceptives have to do with this? I want your answer to that question. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Calling from Tallahassee, Florida. Up first, Santiago. Santiago, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm Catholic, and I teach natural family planning And I just wanted to bring to your attention, and maybe to the people listening, that there's a number of great, great websites, but particularly if you're looking for information on this from Janet Smith. I don't know if you've heard of Dr. Janet Smith.
Peripheral, yes.
Okay, and one of her talks is on tape, and it's spread throughout. It's called Contraception, Why Not? And there's even the whole transcript is on the internet as well.
So what's your basic question or comment here, Santiago?
Well, my comment is to point to the fact that I think the Christian community, especially, not just Catholics. I mean, as you said, most Catholics do not practice what the Church teaches on contraception. But that all Christians in general turn away from this particular topic because, as you say, it's very controversial, and that unfortunately contraception has hurt society, I think, tremendously. And
Santiago, thank you. You know, you don't even have to entertain whether or not it's immoral itself. I mean, this conversation can be had among people who say, look, I don't think contraceptives are bad in and of themselves, but what are their societal effects? That's the question I'm asking. And I'm anxious to hear from those of you who might say, look, I don't think they're bad, and I really don't think they've had a bad effect. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Randy's calling from Warrington. Randy, welcome.
Yeah, hi, Pastor. You there?
I am.
Yeah, what I'd like to, my comment would be is that in birth control pills themselves have three mechanisms of action. That's how they stop a pregnancy. And one of them is by keeping the embryo from implanting after it's already been fertilized. So that would be an abortion right there.
Yes, and I'm glad you point that out. And that raises the question, the genuine moral question, wherein probably more Christians are going to agree about contraceptives when contraceptives are not contraceptives, but contragestational. That is, if they don't or fail to prevent conception, then what they do is fail to, or that they prevent the conception from going any farther than the conception, and it does amount to an abortion. Thank you very much for pointing that out, Randy. Three lines of defense usually in the most common type of the pills: to prevent ovulation, or to restrict it to a certain time, then to prevent conception through various means. The pills have various actions in the woman's body. And then finally, in these triphasic pills, to prevent, if all else fails, the third line of defense is the implantation of the fertilized egg embryo, human baby, in the wall of the uterus. And that does amount to an abortion. Now, the makers of the pill will tell you, I don't know how they know this, but they will tell you it's 2% at the most that third line of defense ever comes into play. Of course, they're the makers of the pill, too. So take that with a grain of salt. I want to hear from some proponents of contraceptives, if any are out there. How have they benefited society? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Katie calls from her car. Katie, welcome.
Hi, thank you. And I don't know if you've already mentioned this, and I don't mean to get you off topic at all, but in that time module, did it mention if it was actual sexual intercourse, or did they say oral sex? Because I think that's a real difference, too, with today's heat.
Actually, what it is a model of, Katie, and I read as carefully as I could, is of, well, romantic relationships that involved, quote-unquote, the exchange of fluids.
Because I think that a lot of it is oral sex because I think that teenagers engage in it because they feel like it's safe. They don't need birth control. But like I said, I don't mean to get you off topic
no.
at all, but I just wanted to mention that.
Not at all. Now, the amazing thing here is, you're right, the amazing thing here is that we have a generation of teenagers who do firmly believe that oral sex is not sex and that it's safe. And by the way, there are certain STDs that the most efficient means of transmitting them from person to person is oral sex. Now, I'm sorry if I know I didn't warn anybody I was going to be using these terms. And if it's offending delicate ears, feel free to listen to something else for a little while. But this is the hard facts. Is this the result of the contraceptive revolution? that we end up talking about this stuff on the air? And not talking about it because we want to do a Howard Stern thing, but talking about it because these are our kids involved in this? Jeff was telling me the other day, he was talking with someone he knows who has experience in public schools. And what are the kids there? In what, junior high and high school, right? Oral sex, no big deal. Not just, wow, isn't that cool? No big deal. Come on. Maybe like holding hands used to be for us. Do you agree or disagree with our last guest, Dr. Brad Wilcox, a sociology professor there at the University of Virginia, who says that there's a direct connection as he looks at the data from secular sociologists between the contraceptive revolution and divorce, the dissolution of the American family in general, adultery, what we would call fornication, sex before marriage, illegitimacy, and the spread of STDs. It's bad for society, regardless of whether you consider it bad in and of itself, bad for society, he says. Do you disagree? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, this is the position I find myself in, to be quite frank. While I vacillate back and forth on the question of whether or not it is moral or immoral, and that's because I have heard biblical arguments mounted, not dueling Bible passages, but biblical arguments mounted on either side of this moral debate, it's hard for me to look at the connection that is drawn by the research and say that, you know, if the pill and other contraceptive forms were a part of the sexual revolution, then they're also a part of bringing about the society of divorce, the anti-family society, the society of sexual promiscuity that we live in today. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In just a little more than 10 minutes, Dr. Carl Fikencher will join us in the second hour of the program. We're going to talk about the presentation of our Lord. Today, the church remembers the visit that Mary, Joseph, and the infant Jesus made at his dedication at the Jerusalem Temple and what happened there. We'll talk about it in about 10 minutes here on Issues, Etc. We'll follow that up with a conversation related a little bit to what we're talking about right now. Jennifer Roback Morris, a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institute, will be our guest. She's got a review of Dr. Phil's new book, Family First. I know a lot of you have that on your shelves. And she's also written an article on the importance of fathers. It's open lines for the remainder of this hour, 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. I remember the last time we talked about contraceptives, we did a roundtable, I believe, with Aaron Wolf, Kevin Voss. Who else did we talk to in that roundtable? I cannot remember who it was. Dr. Bob Weiss. So we did this roundtable on contraceptives. And you can discuss the science until you're blue in the face. I'm asking the question, has it been good for society or bad for society? Annie calls from her car. Annie, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. Well, I'm not sorry to say that I don't believe that contraceptives have been good, but I have a reason for it, and that is that Satan always provides counterfeits, and in this, he's just made people feel safe, and then from feeling safe, then it's sort of very easy to slip down the slope to, well, I'm not going to get caught. And what's happened is we've gotten a huge proliferation of diseases that are very easily spread, and so Satan once again has given us a stone instead of bread.
I like the way you put that, Annie. Thank you very much. And you're absolutely right. Satan's primary modus operandi is to present a counterfeit. That is what a lie is. A lie is a counterfeit of the truth. Some of these lies are so subtle as to be the most dangerous kinds of counterfeits. I was reading recently, I think we were talking about the spread of STDs in a recent conversation, but as Annie's talking there, the words of a doctor, I guess just an internist or a pediatrician, came to me that I had read just a couple days ago, This pediatrician said, look, 20 years ago, if you would have asked me whether I had any compunction about prescribing the pill to a teenage girl, he said, I wouldn't have had any compunction whatsoever. I would have no problems whatsoever 20 years ago in prescribing the pill to a teenage girl. Wouldn't worried about it at all, said this doctor. Then he said, but now I think twice before I prescribe the pill to a teenage girl, and why? Well, this doctor has over time has seen that prescribing a girl the pill in her teenage years means she will be more sexually active, and she will more likely contract a sexually transmitted disease. So the doctor says, look, I'm working against cross purposes with keeping people healthy if I give this girl the pill. He sees the connection between the spread of STDs in his individual patients and the prescription of contraceptives. Can we take that doctor's observation? And this is not a doctor who's interested in the morality of the contraceptives. He's only interested in the impact it's going to have on his patients. And he realizes he is working against their health to prescribe them the pill. Can we take that comment, that observation from that doctor, and write it large across all of society? In to the degree that we have approved or been silent on the issue of contraceptives, we have contributed to all of the things that we're also very worried about. 505-7850-1800-730-2727. You could hear the crickets chirp if there were crickets in the studio. I hope that silence is due to your thinking about this. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. In the next hour, Dr. Carl Fikencher, the presentation of our Lord. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You know, the Pope is lying in a hospital bed. He's in poor health. We hope he'll pull out of it. This Pope has, for the last 27 years, been one of the staunchest defenders of the Roman Church's position on contraceptives. Never wavering, especially not only through the beginnings of the sexual revolution, but through all of the compromise that it's brought to society. And Pope John Paul II obviously knows full well that worldwide Catholics completely disregard, many of them do completely disregard what he and the Church teach about contraceptives. And yet, against all odds and against many in his own church, and certainly against the culture, he says, no, this is wrong. He makes moral arguments, as the church has, against contraceptives. What about just the basic, is it right for society? I cannot help but think that, or you say, well, teenagers are going to go off and have sex anyway, and they're going to spread disease anyway, and they're going to find a way anyway. You know, we were talking about teenage sex the other day on the program, and one thing that didn't come into the conversation, it was in the article that we were basing our conversation on, where do most kids, we were talking to somebody about this, where are they having sex? Where? We say, well, how? How often? What ages? This all gets everyone worried. Mary Eberstadt yesterday, when we were talking, asked the question and answers, where are they having sex? You know what, parents? In your house. You say, no, the back seat of the car, the pickup truck, someone else. No, not someone else's house, your house. Now, Mary Eberstadt says, how much of a brain surgeon does it take to make the connection between parents absent from the home and kids at home, alone? Wait a minute, they're not alone. Their boyfriend's over, and they're having sex in your house. And you and I see the connection without any problem. And all the alarm bells go off for us. I'm asking whether or not we can make another connection between that very scenario, your kids having sex in your house. Not only because you're gone, but because maybe you've let your daughter go on the pill. And don't say, oh, Christian parents don't do that. Yes, they do. And I'm looking at this chain of affection in the Time magazine. And these children, they are children, by the way. They're not adults yet. They're in high school. And the 1 or 2 degrees of separation between little blue dot over here and little pink dot way over on the other side of the chain of affection, and the STDs that she contracted were very easily passed along the line in 18 months. This is only 18 months. This isn't over your entire high school career. That little blue dot on the right side got the STD that the girl on the little pink dot on the other side contracted in month one. And I'm thinking, you may say, oh, it's a public school. Those aren't Christian kids. Yes. Statistically, half of them are going to be church-going kids. So is there a connection here? Jason writes this from Durham, North Carolina. My sister-in-law, in studying women's studies at a liberal East Coast university, where these women are taught that it is actually psychologically damaging to tell a teen to be abstinent. Is that a result also of contraception? We say, look, sex is disconnected from marriage, and once sex is divorced from marriage, then where does it float? Wherever you want it to. And suddenly sex becomes not only the right, but the duty of people who to be sexually active, to be socially active. And you pour the pill into the mix, and it's made all the easier. And then we have people at East Coast colleges in women's studies departments teaching the undergraduates and the graduates that you will psychologically damage your teen if you tell them not to have sex. So if you eliminate the consequences of sex outside of marriage with contraceptives, and you don't, we wouldn't want to hurt their feelings or their delicate psyches by telling them to abstain. It's a terrible mix. Matt calls from his car. Matt, we have less than a minute.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
Hey, I just have three thoughts on this issue.
Real quick.
One, I've always wondered what the health reason for using birth control as far as regulating the menstrual cycle is, and because I've heard a lot of women say that they use it because they need to regulate their periods.
And your other 2 points?
And the other one is, I wondered if there's a connection between that and the huge amount of infertility going on now between married couples who, women were on birth control since they were in their teens, and now they're in their 20s trying to have kids and they can't.
Yep.
And then third thing, how would we ever possibly, as Christians, abolish it? Because, I mean, once abortion was made legal, now it seems like it's a huge uphill battle to ever see that go away. And how would we ever, except for maybe from a medical standpoint, ever get rid of contraception?
Matt, thank you very much. Look, the experts in STDs are telling us why so many young women are infertile in their 20s. It's because of the STDs they got when they were teenagers. And again, I asked about the connection with contraceptives. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.